It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist?
Hello. So after the end of the highest ever goal-scoring game week, we're back to pick over the wreckage with, it's fair to say, contrasting fortunes on the pod this week. Now, apologies for one day later than usual, but that's because of a time zone difference, as you'll find out in terms of who our guest is this week. We do, of course, like to challenge them, but making them record at 3 or 4 a.m. is probably more torture than a captain fail, so we thought we'd kind of leave it to the next day. Right, let's go on with it. It's a long old pod here. Nick, you're right. Would you mind introducing our guest?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I'm good, thanks. It was definitely a punishing game week for me with 44 goals scored in the Premier League, which was a record. Unfortunately, my team only got 3 of those. Just a reminder who we are Who Got the Assist. You can find us on Twitter, generally at WGTA_FPL or at WGTA_Nick or at FPL Stag, or also on Instagram. And welcome to the new listeners as well. Don't forget to hit subscribe if you like what you hear. Finally, if you want to join our mini league, the code as well is CPSULF. So, yeah, as Tom alluded to, we're delighted to be joined by late riser this game week, otherwise known as Pradil Chef, India's number one manager last season and infamous upside chaser. And you can find him on Twitter as well, at LaterRiser12. He's also recently launched a pod with fellow FPL veterans Big Man Bakar and Zofar called the FPL Wire, which you can also find on all the pod repositories. So, late riser, Pradil, thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm doing good. Excited to be here talking to you guys. I've been listening to you guys for most of last year, enjoyed the pods, and also very recently realized how much hard work goes into it. So yeah, looking forward to this.
Evening, everyone, and welcome, Late Riser. Great to have you joining us for the pod, and great timing for us to get you this week, given that your wildcard is active along with so many others. As for this week's pod and fitting the backdrop with so many wildcards active, we'll be considering how we pick a player in FPL in this pod. Later on after the break, we'll have a mini-league update and the correspondence section, a bit better than usual in that it is a deep focus on the Sterling versus KDB debate. And we're going to finish off then, as standard, with quickfire listener questions and look at our transfers and captains. However, before all that, we'll have the Gamer Review and Market Forces.
Cool, right. Game review. Who came lowest this week? I got 56.
Oh no, it could be me.
It could be me.
I got 46.
46. Can we do any worse?
45, yeah.
It's just like the worst episode of Antiques Roadshow ever. 48.
48. All right. Okay, Pranil, do you want to go first? Let us know how the game week went.
It was terrible. I had Aubameyang, Fernandez, St. Max in midfield. I had Dele Alli who didn't start, and I had Bissouma coming on for him. I thought he did well to give me a good 3 points. I was happy about that. Then he goes on and gets that red card right at the end. Yeah, so it was all terrible, and it started off so well. The first game of the week was Everton. I had Calvert-Lewin got me a hat-trick. I thought, okay, finally, something good's going to happen. Then just sad story after that.
Yeah, well, mine wasn't much better, to be honest. 1 point more than you. I don't want to moan too much, because I've certainly seen some really bad horror shows on Twitter. The likes of Hindu Monkeys had think it was 23 at a -4 or something. So that's pretty damn terrible. But I did look at my game week rank this week, which was 4.9 million, which was actually worse than any of last season. So last season, my worst game week rank was 4.8 million. So not a good start to the season. Yeah, it wasn't great. Just Aubameyang was the captain. He only got an assist, which was pretty rubbish. And I guess my only get-outs were Mitrovic, who turned up with a brace out of nowhere, and James Justin also got a bit of a surprising goal, but everyone else blanked. And also, you know, Luca Dean, who I brought in for Van Dijk, cost me a net -6 on that transfer, so that didn't work out very well. I was particularly unhappy during that Everton game when everyone else was returning and Dean just was sitting on a one pointer.
You were not very a happy bunny on the Slack, were you? And Anthony?
Yeah, not as catastrophic. 48 points. So drop, I guess. Anyone who had a good week in game week one typically had a bad game week two, unless they happened to be very good with their transfers. So with that in mind, to be at a 1.2 mil overall rank after 2 weeks, I think I'll take it with the way things are all quite bunched up at the moment. I moved Ings to Richarlison, so that was pretty much no gain. Captain Aubameyang, like everyone and their mother, so that was 10 points there. And then it's Alexander-Arnold and Justin, 7 points each. And then the rest was Cat.
Fair enough. And I've got 56 this week. I entitled this on Twitter, Me in the Bedroom, because it started really well and ended meh. I moved in Hammers, took out Kai Havertz and got the instant reward. I got 12-pointer there for him. And, you know, it was all looking up, 24 from the first two players after that. Yeah, nothing really happened. Aubameyang with the assist, you know, Trent with 1 point from the clean sheet, Justin with the random goal. I only got 2 goals this week from the ridiculous number of goals there were. And we're all nodding here, so I guess it kind of sums up the kind of week it was for a lot of people. But yeah, 56, the rank doesn't matter, but it just felt really underwhelming with people, you know, celebrating Son and celebrating X, Y, and Z. And you're like, oh, I really wish that my players came through like that, but they just didn't this week. So I've taken a -8 actually. So, but maybe I've taken, I'm already where Anthony is, but
-8.
Yeah, I'll take them on, yeah. Spoilers. Anyway, let's go to the market forces then, see who else is as rash as I have been. Nick, man across numbers, let's be a bit quicker this week, but just to summarise, what's been going down?
I think a lot of managers were punished by the madness of the market last week, as we saw like heavily sold players like Son and Ings punishing their sellers, and also people that did moves like Salah to Mane, as we said before, falling victim to the red roulette there. So a lot of managers last week were punished, but this week it's Dominic Calvert-Lewin actually that's the most popular player right now to bring in, with 640,000 transfers in at time of recording. He's not going to be playing West Brom every week, but certainly with 4 goals in 2 games so far, a lot of people are looking at him and thinking, can he do better than he did last season? Obviously, during the post-lockdown period, he was particularly dry, but good start for him. Otherwise, it's also Son Heung-min. As I said, 424,000 transfers out last week, but already 550,000 transfers back in. So many people perhaps even just yo-yoing between Son. And actually, just on the transfers outside, we've got almost the opposite there with Bruno Fernandes. He's the fourth most transferred out midfielder right now. Was on the top 5 transfers in last week, but already 237,000 managers have sent Bruno packing straight away. And that looks like another transfer perhaps that might bite people in the posterior.
Yeah, I really couldn't get over just the kind of the constant theme really of players that we had in our most sold last week banging. So amongst the ones you named, so we've Son, Mane, Aubameyang if you count it, Ings, Mitrovic, Antonio, Kane. They were among the top 10 in terms of players sold last week, and then they go and do pretty well this week. So definitely impatience definitely not being rewarded.
Yeah, definitely. Otherwise, third most transferred in player is James Rodriguez with 540,000 transfers in. He really impressed in game week 1 and game week 2, and Everton have some really good fixtures, so a lot of love for him right now. Also Bamford, he was top last week, but still popular with 400,000 transfers in. He's risen 0.2 million already in value. However, he's got some tougher fixtures coming up with likes of Sheffield United and Man City up next. So we'll see how he gets on. And finally, in terms of the top 5 most transferred in, we've also got Kevin De Bruyne. So a lot of people now looking at him. Obviously, they didn't have a game in game week 1, but game week 2, he looked really, really impressive. So 420,000 managers have also brought him in for the goal and assist. And it's rumoured he's going to be playing a number 10 position. He's on penalties as well. So a lot of love for De Bruyne right now.
Yeah, we'll definitely see. And you know what Stag alluded to, all of that sort of the roller coaster I said that really poshly, the roller coaster of ups and downs and ins and outs of the transfer market has definitely caused some introspection. One person who has kind of come forward is Mark from Fan Football Scout, who's obviously the Don, and he said that would locking prices for the first four game weeks improve the game and make it more accessible? He said it's a frustration for seasoned managers who get driven into points hits and wildcards to avoid drops. And he says also it's got to be worth putting, you know, to newcomers, especially with the system obviously not being particularly clear. I mean, Pranil, what do you think? Would you be in favour of, you know, the first four game weeks having locked prices?
I am not in favour of locking the prices. I think it adds an element of variance, and, you know, we have a clear differentiation between the guys who are patient versus the guys who are aggressive. And FPL is a game of temperament, right? So let us have that you know, factor of variance between the two styles of managerial play. I mean, we don't have to play FIFA in amateur mode, right? So yeah, I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the market is a unique part of FPL, which forces, you know, the risk and reward calls, which make it all the more enveloping, engaging, I guess. I mean, you know, for example, the sales this week, Aubameyang 500k, in third, Timo Werner 286,000 sales ahead of West Brom. You've got to be looking at that and thinking, wow, okay, that's a risk reward call that hopefully Werner owners are going to be thinking, well, I'm going to be on the right side of that. And I kind of wonder as well whether if you've got it frozen for the first four game weeks that when the market does reopen in game week four, we'd all be sat on a pretty similar sort of team, wouldn't we? After looking at the first 4 weeks of data and just kind of thinking, well, okay, I can merge all these players into 100. I mean, it doesn't quite happen with Sky, but I just don't like it as much.
But Pranil, maybe just to build on that a little bit, would you be pro if the actual system for price changes was more transparent?
I personally don't really care too much about the prices. So I'm okay with them not being so transparent. I think it adds an element of uncertainty, chaos, panic, which I think is good for the game generally. I don't think it should be so easy, you know? So yeah.
Okay, that's fair enough. So I think I'd probably be on the side of a little bit of transparency with the actual price changes would be nice, just so that you don't make the transfer on a Tuesday before a Champions League game or something later in the season when, you know, you could make it on the Wednesday and know what's going to happen. But as you say, a little bit of chaos is nice. But after weeks like game week two, I find there's enough chaos in FPL as it is.
I quite like the wildness of the prices as well. And I'd say maybe you could freeze the prices for the first week, but I don't know about freezing them for the first four. I think certainly, like, it does create a bit of clamour, a bit of excitement. You know, everyone's drafting in players in and out to kind of catch the rise at the beginning of the season, which can add an extra element to the game, which is quite exciting. And it's not like the prices are, like, increasing rapidly or too crazily anyway. We're only talking about a couple of players that have got up 0.2 so far. So I don't think it's like we're seeing, you know, a player jump up 0.6, 0.7 within a couple of weeks and instantly unaffordable. It's pretty relaxed, I think.
Yeah, it's not the end of the world, is it? If a player goes up or down 0.1, he says sitting on the minus 8, taking it because a player was dropping 0.1. Anyway, I think the chaos that Anthony alluded to is a very, very good sort of environment for the pod that we're about to do, which is what we look for in an FPL player. That's the kind of the salient question we'll be looking at today. Perfect with Pranil on here because obviously the guy is an absolute god at spotting that player just before he's about to break. I mean, we're thinking Martial hat-trick against Sheffield United here, aren't we? But to do this, we're going to look at a few kind of factors that may influence why we look at an FPL player, both, I guess, in terms of a transfer and also in terms of a captain. Broadly, of course, this is going to break down into the age-old eye test versus data debate. Yes, so we're very pleased to hear we'll be looking at that today. But hopefully giving it a WGTA spin, hopefully giving it a little bit of a kind of a strategic look rather than just kind of saying that guy looked pretty good. He's worth buying because he's got 5 shots in the last 2 games. Let's start off with the eye test, one that always crops up every year. You hear people kind of going, oh, you know what? Yeah, you know, I don't really like stats. It's all about the eye test. So in terms of the eye test, what are we looking for from a player that we're kind of scouting for FPL reasons? Pranil, let's go with you first. So to set the groundwork, what sort of things are high in mind for you when you're eyeing a player up to potentially come into your team?
The few things I look at, I mean, he needs to be a goal scorer. He needs to be in and around the box. I am generally more attracted to the goal scorer kind of players compared to the assisters that we have. That's why I've never owned KDB too much last season. And I think I need to change that thinking in my mindset. Somebody is around the box, in and around the box, even if he's not getting the chances, you know, if there's somebody putting in the cross, is he around the area where somebody's going to be connecting the cross? That's something I look at. And that's a practice I have actually when I'm watching match of the day, you know, where I'm sitting with the fixture, sitting with the stats, and then watching the game. And after every game that I see the highlights, I actually go through the fixtures and the stats at that same time. So it sort of registers in my head. And one other thing that I look at is how well the team is playing. Is the team creating a high enough volume of chances? When we talk about, you know, Spurs last season post-restart, Kane and Son were in the conversation, but I just didn't think Spurs were creating as many chances, which is why I felt like I didn't want to go there. Even the quality of the chances matters. You know, we're going to talk about big chances later, but that's why I've always been attracted to a person like Sadio Mane, because he gets... people talk a lot about his conversion rate, but his conversion rate is good because the quality of the chance that he gets is always high. You know, he always gets chances in and around the box. Generally, in terms of form, things you can look at is if a player is not scuffing a shot or not snatching at them. If you remember Salah last season in a post-restart, he was trying too hard. You could see that while watching the game. He was scuffing or chances.
Snatching at it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So those are the few things that I look for when I'm watching the game when it comes to the eye test.
Yeah, very interesting sort of qualitative edge to those. But certainly, as you say, you've got the kind of I'm imagining you like watching football on one screen right in front of you and having like a tablet and a laptop open, and you've got it all sort of there just looking through it. Yeah, really interesting. Anthony, Nick, what sort of things do you look at?
When you're watching a Premier League match and you're trying to apply the eye test, sometimes it's those players that look like they're performing really well on the pitch, but they're not necessarily good for FPL. And I think that's the distinction that we have to sometimes call out. I've seen it before with well-known troll Eden Hazard. You know, he was winning sort of man of the match week in, week out, but he wasn't returning any FPL points during that particular period that I owned him. And you've got other characters like that. You know, Wilfred Zaha from previous season. He had a good start so far this season. Previous seasons, you see him on the ball a lot, you know, looking like he's making lots of runs forward, but would inevitably be fouled and then the chance would be squandered and he'd also not get any returns. And then on the offhand, you've also got these characters that we mentioned, you know, the likes of Mitrovic or Jamie Vardy's, you know, the famous example, and he's been a good example as well from the start of this season. He's not really been in the game, you know, he's barely touching the ball. His touches are, you know, very, very low in terms of what he's actually doing, but it's his positioning. He's not, you know, great for statistics. And we always call out Vardy kind of defies the statistics, but he's there, he's waiting. He's waiting for that chance to pounce on, to put into the back of the net. So he's kind of the perfect example of someone who's good on the eye test, but not necessarily from a statistical standpoint.
Just to build, I guess, on what the lads have said to a degree, I think what the eye test allows me to do is to contextualize the data that we see by understanding the tactical role of a player. So you have, let's say, with the attackers, to use that example again, you need to understand why a player is taking such a volume of shots, maybe seeing that they're a wing player who's involved in the game, and I'm using involved there with quotes, so your Richarlisons, your Harvey Barneses, your Mo Salahs, and contrasting that with your Fox in the Box, Vardy type players who, if you look at the stats, he's not going to scream at you. He's not going to scream out with his numbers in terms of numbers of shots. But if you see how he plays over the course of seasons, especially, you start to understand the data and start to understand his role in the team is just to get those shots and pretty much do nothing else. Also, what the eye test is quite useful for understanding is the quality of the team around a player and how players, their relationships are on the pitch and who intersects with who. So the likes of a person who knits play like David Silva used to do, who, yes, he would assist the assister a lot, and that's quite frustrating, but he would still record double figures for assists by being part of such a goal-scoring side, being in the right part of the pitch, and inevitably creating chances with incisive passes from time to time. And look, of course, it's no comparison is perfect, but take Youri Tielemans, for example, at Leicester. Like Leicester score less. Tielemans is not typically giving a final ball to Vardy if you look at any of their matches. So he doesn't have that same attraction that someone like David Silva was, even though they play similar, and I'm getting my quotes out for similar again, assisting the assister typically type roles. James Ward-Prowse is another who you could kind of put into that category.
Yeah, and that certainly makes sense. I think the only other thing as well that I'd throw in, without reiterating a few really good points that have been made, is for the lesser teams, one thing I do always look for is the set-piece setups. So on pre-season pod, I mentioned Konsa at Aston Villa, who scored this weekend. And I was actually a little bit annoyed because I moved him out for ailing. I think that was one of the last things that I did. And I was just kind of looking at 15-pointer thinking, oh, if only. But that was something I noticed in the restart, that he and I think House had a very, very good start to the restart. Then Konsa kind of came in as Mings's kind of number two. And throughout the course of that restart, he was always one of the targets for both a knock-on and also just the key target itself for those egregious delivery. So in terms of those smaller teams, that set play, POMO sort of thing is something that I do always look for. I completely agree with what Pranil was saying about the quality of chances. So things like the creative players as well, who they're passing it to, who they're not passing it to as well. Like, you can definitely see that sometimes that a certain player isn't quite, it's not quite working for them. I'm thinking Jose Perez last year, making the runs when he first went to Leicester, but the runs that were getting in the way of everybody else. And as soon as he got taken off and Albrighton was brought on, the team functioned a lot better. So little things like that, I think, are very, very good indicators as well.
Perez's example is actually really good, because then you start to notice the system and the pattern of play that the team has. I mean, and the best example for this is Doherty at Wolves, right? Because we knew that if the ball came on the other side, it was his job to get inside the box to meet the end of the cross. Now, that is something which you notice is a consistent pattern of the play for that team. So that's something you watch out for as well.
Absolutely. In terms of how stats and the eye test sort of intertwine, I guess, there's always that question, would you ever buy a player on the eye test alone? I don't think any of us would in the pub without doing kind of a general vox pop here. I think the fundamental truth behind that is that I think the four of us could all watch a game of football, and I think the four of us would all have a different take on what happened. And it's very, very good to contextualize and moderate that with stats. So the eye test is obviously a very subjective thing. You see what you see and see what you want to see in some cases. So say, you know, I fancy bringing a player in this week. I'm watching them and I kind of think, oh yeah, they look fantastic. Forgetting other things, confirmation bias, yeah. The stats, I guess, are more objective, caveats around research bias, of course, but they kind of help you kind of put things together and create a full picture. The eye test is always useful, but it's contextualized by stats. So in terms of these key stats, and definitely something that I'm guessing, Pranil, you're looking at a lot being on the wild card at the moment, what sort of key metrics are the ones which catch your eye? Which ones are you looking at? Which ones do you value?
So when it comes to the players and the attackers, the two big stats that I always look at are shots in the box and big chances. I think these two personally give me the clearest indication in terms of who is going to get those FPL points. And one stat that I always like looking at is the offensive and defensive form of teams as well. How much are the teams creating in terms of shots in the box and big chances, and how much are teams conceding in terms of shots in the box and big chances? And I try to then look at the fixture ticker and try to see that who's going to face these teams who are going to concede a lot of shots in the box and big chances.
Do you just focus on goals? Do you look to assists at all?
I think that's a weakness in my game, because I primarily, when it comes to attackers, focus on goals. To look at the assists, I look at the XGI stat, but my primary focus is on the shots in the box and big chances. And exception to that is players like De Bruyne. But
About to say, it probably explains how you didn't have De Bruyne maybe more in previous years.
And I think what I need to filter in my head is the quality of the player. Because, De Bruyne plays deeper, but even if he's 10 yards further, the quality of his pass is much greater than anybody else in the league. So that's something you need to factor in as well.
I think for me, it's a largely similar set in terms of my forwards and midfielders. It's the shots in the box. I compare those two a bit and to the team. Non-pen XG is a big deal for me. And who's on pens? I know that's not a key stat, but it is definitely a factor, which I would have considered before. And I'm definitely considering now this season. Chances created and big chances created are definitely something that I look into as well. To be honest, maybe the opposite of Pernil, I've probably put too much emphasis on assists and chances created in the past to the detriment of just not getting the bloody points into my team. In terms of defenders, it's in terms of the team, it's the shots in the box conceded and their XGC. Then I look to stuff like the defenders' chances created and their final third touches. Just I feel if they're up that end of the pitch, they'll pass the ball to somebody and get an assist every so often, which is obviously better than not. Then I look to set pieces. If they take them, great. And then I look at the chances from set pieces, which I guess is Tom's Conser rule from previously. I just look at that as like a ballpark idea of like, is this guy's head getting on the end of crosses? One of them will go in eventually. And so that's how I'd pick out a centre-back, for example, that goes up for a corner.
In the past as well, with Nick's man Rico, there's been who's taken the free kicks and the corners as well. I think that's one of the parameters that got Nick involved with the Bournemouth man.
I look at stuff like penalty box touches as well, and that's an indication of who's in the getting into the right positions, who's creating those chances, who's getting those chances. Shots on target, obviously, shots inside the box, chances created, big chances created, all key stats. I think with the defences, I try and look at some of the team stats as well. So I'm always interested in attack and defend, of course. So I look at some of those same metrics, but I also look at the team stats to see how they're doing in terms of how many shots they're conceding, you know, how many goals they've conceded, and also how decent is their goalkeeper as well. So, for instance, with Chelsea, you've got characters like Kepa, which will put you off the Chelsea defence. But, you know, obviously, when you had Dean Henderson at Sheffield United, that was one of the most important factors in regards to owning a Sheffield United defender. And, you know, as I highlighted with Ramsdale, I don't necessarily think Sheffield United defences are strong with Ramsdale in goal compared to Henderson.
No, fair enough. I think maybe I'm lazy, but all I really look at these days, and you guys look at a lot of the analog data, the big chances and shots and things like that, I just look at the expected data now. It contextualizes the eye test very nicely for me and sums it all up in one sort of nice little neat package. And I hear what you guys are saying, and I completely agree in terms of the broad idea, which is for offensive players, you look at individual metrics, and for defenses, you look at kind of team metrics. And that completely makes sense. Like with the expected data, what I really like is the fact that it helps me sort of filter the understanding of what's going on. So, for example, last year, Jack Grealish, second most chances created. You think about that, thinking, wow, that looks incredible. When we look at the quality of the chances he's created in the data itself, he created those 91 chances, but last year his XA was just 8.22. That's 13th on the list. So, 91 of his chances, only 9 of them are big chances. Only a 10% ratio of them, basically. Compared to Richarlison, yeah, he's not a creative player, but 39% of the chances he created were big chances. What this means is Grealish creates volume, but he doesn't create quality. Compare that to someone like Richarlison, yeah, okay, he's got Dominic Calvert-Lewin or whatever, but it does mean he's creating best quality chances, so he's got a better chance of scoring you points effectively. And if you add in, yes, Mr. Samatta and Mr. Wesley being the people who have to eat the dinner that Grealish is creating, it kind of helps you kind of understand, okay, great kind of headline analog stat and he looks fantastic in the game, but how much quality is he adding to
you're,
his team?
You're in good company, Tom, because actually Fabio Borges, he's a very well-known manager who's sitting on, I think, number one spot in the FFS Hall of Fame. He swears by the expected data when it comes to the stats, and he primarily looks at only that.
Yeah, but I'm a crap manager and he's a good manager. I don't know how that works. But I think, and the only one as well that I just quickly to mention is XGI. That's kind of my king stat, just because it basically is our points close. If you compare that to the delta, how much are they expected to be involved in goals or assists, and what's the difference? I know that's something that Fabio also looks at as well, so I'm kind of quite happy about that. That's something I've always looked at. So it sounds like kind of, yeah, broadly, player looks good, he passes all those sort of markers. For the defence, it's those team metrics. For the offences, it's those sort of individual metrics. What about things like kind of fixtures, ownership, all these sort of other sort of data points which are in the FPL universe? What other ones do we pay attention to? I mean, Pranil, you're on record on Twitter as saying F the template again and again and again. That probably covers ownership. And for you, it's quite an individual sort of path you try to forge, right?
Yeah.
Does ownership matter?
Actually, so my outlook towards ownership is a little different, and I'm very opportunistic when it comes to ownership. So when I'm making my team players, I barely ever scroll into the eye on the FPL page and look at how much ownership they have. My decision making is based on solely what I see, and then, like you said, you know, it's validated by the stats that we sort of contextualize what's happening in the game. But ownership is something I'm interested in primarily during the captaincy decision, and when there's a 50-50 call or a 40-60 call, and if I see that there's a low owned player who presents an opportunity to make big grounds in terms of points, it's something I'm drawn towards, especially if I'm owning the highly owned player, you know, so that's sort of insurance because you have 100% effective ownership anyway. So that's something I look at in terms of being opportunistic rather than, you know, the more shield concept that people talk about.
I don't tend to focus too much on ownership or who's in the Twitter template. I kind of, you know, try and forge my own kind of plans in terms of who I'm picking, who's in my team, and kind of base it on my own decisions. I try not to let myself get influenced overly by the template and stuff like that. I think in regards to fixtures, I think fixtures are very, very important. You know, I'm always looking to target those weakened teams or those teams that look poor, you know, like the Bournemouth, for instance, from last season. This season, I think it's going to be about who's playing Fulham or who's playing West Brom or even Southampton if they if they don't sort out their defence and their high line. So I think fixtures are very, very important and something that I strongly consider when I'm making my transfers.
Another question for you, actually, Pranil, based on the fixtures there. To what extent do you look at home and away fixtures, especially maybe with captaincy, I guess, as opposed to picking players? And then, especially in the context of lockdown, this has been something I've been kind of harping on about a little bit in the Slack lately, is why are people still talking about home and away as if it's the big deal when there's nobody in the stadiums? It's just, you know, it's just another cavernous building.
It doesn't influence my thinking as much as it should, especially since lockdown that you mentioned, because I think the advantage isn't as great as it used to be. And, you know, when we're captaining players, we're generally looking at teams like Manchester City or Liverpool, or if they're in form, Chelsea or Man United. And when it comes to these teams, it's primarily about the quality of the attack. So I don't think home and away matters as much when it comes to the quality and the difference in quality between the opposition and the current team being so drastic.
Okay, that's quite interesting. I guess for me, ownership, especially now at the start of the season, it's a big, you know, it's not really that important. Although as the season does develop, I do pay quite a bit of attention, probably more attention than I should, to the top 10K ownership, just to get an idea of, I guess, where I might be vulnerable more than anything. And if I feel I need to address that, then fair enough. In other things that maybe kind of might interest me in terms of like assessing my stats, I tend to try and look at, let's say, 8 or 9 games tends to be my kind of perfect amount of time to look back. But at the same time, you have to take into account fixture difficulty then, and of course on the horizon for a player you're looking at. And then I think something that we've just omitted and we should probably talk about is something that I probably haven't put enough emphasis on, and I think we should all be kicking ourselves we didn't talk about it on last week's pod, and it's tactical. And it's something like Southampton's insanely high line. It was already an issue for them against Crystal Palace with Wilfried Zaha. He had a few opportunities, one of them offside, another one he scored from, another one he missed. Basically against that same line that Son and Kane exploited to wonderful effect at the weekend. And like, it was a complete liability against Spurs. And maybe we should be paying greater attention to it. But at the same time, there is the aspect of you couldn't possibly have expected Ralf Hasenhüttl to walk into that trap and, you know, give us such a disaster class in Premier League football tactics as well.
No, definitely not. It reminded me, funnily enough, of when Pep Guardiola first faced Leicester City as Man City manager, and he played a high line against Jamie Vardy, of all people. And you're kind of thinking, all right, dude, I mean, on one hand, you've got, right, this worked fine for me everywhere else. But, I mean, Vardy just tore him to pieces, didn't he?
It was the year after Leicester had won the title as well. Their form was crap. Ranieri was still the manager, and Vardy got a hat-trick out of nowhere. And you're like, what?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. It was very much kind of, it was almost like hubris on Pep's part, just thinking, oh, my tactics will beat out of these guys. No, definitely not. Maybe it's a case of going back to what Pranil was saying when, in terms of the team and looking at the team when you're doing the eye test and helping to spot those sort of team patterns. That sort of thing is quite useful. And in that way, kind of that's more like a team weakness, perhaps, like how they got it. And of course, that kind of comes out in the stats as well, like where teams are conceding chances from, for example. So maybe this weekend, you may be looking at the fact that James Justin and Timmy Castagna can't seem to defend at all. So maybe someone like Raheem Sterling may be a good shout. You never know.
Good you mentioned about, Ralf and Pep, because also when you're reading the games week on week, especially for the captaincy decision, it's important to take into context whether the manager tends to game manage or he's very principled in terms of these are my principles and I'm going to play this way, you know, when you're talking about, let's say, a Bielsa or a Ralf, because they're very stubborn in terms of, no, this is my playstyle, I'm going to proceed with this and I'm not going to game manage no matter what. So that's something you take into context as a read after the game against Spurs.
Oh, yeah, certainly. I definitely like what you're saying about kind of reading the game there and kind of making that work in terms of what your decisions are and how everything sort of knits together. The final thing I just wanted to mention as well, in terms of, I think Stag mentioned it earlier, in terms of 8 or 9 sort of fixtures in the past, something that's kind of been on my mind a little bit the last few weeks, and it's definitely going to be an acute thing next week with Chelsea playing West Brom, is at what point do we kind of start to size up one of the newer players to the league and think, oh, actually, you might be worth it. So I think we probably all started perhaps with one of the new players to the league in our team game week one. I certainly had Kai Havertz, for example, which was absolutely terrible. Like, do we go for these sort of tried and trusted players always, every single time? Or do we kind of take risks? Do we use things like, you know, scout reports and things like that and kind of hope a player's going to work, especially in the case of someone like Timo Werner? Like, do players need to have that sort of long-term history to be of interest to us? Or would we take a punt, for example, the kind of Mo Salah straight into the league and smashing it sort of situation? Bruno?
I don't mind taking the gamble. I also think like it adds excitement and fun to the game. And at the end of the day, you're playing the game for fun, right? So if you're getting a player who's looking exciting and you have a hunch that he's going to do well in the league, go for it. And we've had, people talk about the poor cases, but there we've had enough good cases as well. You know, Diego Costa, he came into the league, he started off on a good note, and Mo Salah is one. You know, we've had enough examples of people who started off really well. So I think it's fine take that gamble if you really feel it. And I mean, why are you playing the game if you're not backing those hunches that you had?
So I mean, I did that. I kind of backed my hunch on Kai Havertz after watching him in the Bundesliga. And he and Timo Werner, as I said last week, just night and day, weren't they, in terms of how good they were in the first game, certainly, and in the first couple of games. It's just extraordinary, like, how some players really just take to it like a duck to water, and other players really kind of dipping their toes in, and they kind of just slowly getting used to it. But absolutely, I think having fun, especially, is absolutely huge. Why don't you back your hunches? Well, it's one of those things that the FPL Twitter environment and social media can definitely kind of push you out of, right?
Yep.
Cool. All right. So I think just in terms of rounding off, I think that was a really good discussion. I think overall, it just sounds like in terms of the eye test, that kind of helps us spot players, spot patterns, spot team patterns, and that helps us contextualize the stats. And in those stats, we break up offense into individual data, defense into team data, and use that to create sort of a rounded picture, ideally. But as Pernille said, have fun. It's always quite good to kind of back those hunches. And if a player doesn't quite conform to the stats, doesn't quite conform to what the zeitgeist is saying, but you fancy him, I always say, as you may see me respond on Twitter, if you like it, go for it. That's definitely the case. But hopefully that's helped you in terms of how you assess if a player is good for you. And we're going to take a break now and come back to the Q&A after this.
Who got the assist?
So we're back and it's time to catch up with the Who Got the Assist mini league. As I said earlier, if you want to join the league code is CPSULF. And I'm just going to run through quickly the top six, perhaps, just because the guy in sixth just got an insanely good score. So that's Isma Diaspin with IDSFT. He got 133 points this game week, which is just an incredible score. So that was a gaming rank of 1,308. And he captained Son, obviously, for 48 points. We also had the likes of Kane and Ings and Zaha, and also Alisson in goal. So just a huge, huge return there. In fifth was Abid Rosham with Winnie the Kapue. He got 105 points. Gali Adicha with 115 points in fourth. In third was James Dayton with Dyslexia Untied. He got 104 points. In second was 06 with 116 points. And in first was Hirsch Pandya with FPL Mumbai. 120 points for him. He's 570th overall rank and also 15th in India. So a little bit of competition there, Pranil, this season.
Yep, for sure. I don't have a complete total combined with both game weeks that these guys have in one. So
you'll get there, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll be leaving them in your dust very, very soon. All right, let's move on to the correspondence. And this week, it's actually a boon to have the correspondence for once. It is...
Whoa, there's shots fired at the correspondence.
It is hanging by a cord, and I have my scissors just waiting for it to fail. But this week, we actually do have a very, very good piece of correspondence, don't we, Anthony?
Yeah, this week's correspondence definitely falls under the category of an addendum, I guess, to last week's pod, and it's hyper-relevant as well. So last week, we were discussing the big Manchester City question, KDB or Sterling, and to be honest, all three of us just brushed through it too quickly, and we fell on the side of Sterling. Anyway, FPL Elf, found on Twitter, at Elf FPL, where he offers, as he says himself, memes, gifs, and sass mixed with a bit of FPL, quite rightly pulled us up on this with a fine letter of correspondence, which he sent to whogottheassist@gmail.com. Hi guys, on last week's pod, you had a question, KDB or Sterling? Nick initially opted for KDB, based mainly on him being highly owned. However, he switched to Sterling due to his explosive nature and his ceiling, which he thought was a lot higher than KDB's. Anthony Stagg opted for KDB, stating he's better, before U-turning to say he thinks that Sterling's ceiling is higher than KDB's, making him the better pick. Tom went for Sterling, calling it a case of goals over assists, and also said he could get you the explosive returns. So, all three of you went for Sterling over KDB, basically due to him having the higher ceiling. But does he? Elf says that he couldn't be bothered to look deeply into the stats, as that's what we're here for, right? But what Elf did do is he looked at their top 10 highest game week scores from last season. Sterling's highest was 21, KDB's was 19. Second highest for Sterling was 20, KDB again 19. Then, KDB had 7 scores of 11 points and above. Sterling only had 3 weeks where he went over 11 points. So, Elf finishes. So, whilst based on last year's returns, Sterling did just pip KDB for the high score. It was only by 2 points. Is that really enough to say that Sterling is a better pick due to his ceiling? KDB practically matched Sterling with the highest scores, and was then far more prolific with his number of hauls? Or is it just a case that Sterling has the headroom to explode even further than this? Because if not, he can't really see a case for Sterling over KDB. He signs off with, I love you, Elf.
Oh, thank you, Elf. Yes, so I listened back, and this is perhaps a positive in the correspondence sections column, because it means that people are able to kind of say, right, hang on, that was a little bit rash. Because obviously at this pod, we do like to say things which are evidenced, and I think the issue with the Q&A quickfire sometimes is that we're less prepared for those and may have given a reflection of our impressions rather than the facts. And I think this is a very interesting question, especially one which is cropping up this week. As we mentioned earlier, lots of Aubameyang sales, and people either already made the decision or they're looking to kind of make their choice between the Ginger Prince and Raheem Sterling. Pranil, I assume that you're straight on your man Sterling, right?
I'm currently thinking about going in with both at the moment, because I can't seem to separate them. So I want to leave that decision for later. But there's a thinking behind it now. We saw that KDB in the last game played further forward than he does usually. And I was wondering about this preseason as well, you know, because if we don't have Dilwa, what midfield is Pep going to play? And I thought KDP is playing further forward. And that's why he'll be a little more predictable in terms of captaincy options. What do you think, Tom?
Well, I mean, I've re-examined the facts after doing this, and I bought KDB. I did this before the Wolves game, so I've got the timestamp. I wasn't just influenced by that. And frankly, I see what you mean in terms of buying them both. So Sterling outscored KDB in the restart. KDB outscored Sterling for the season. Sterling managed goal involvement 32% of City's games, KDB in 36. Per start, it kind of favours KDB, 39% for KDB, 34% for Sterling. In the restart, massively Sterling, 50% Sterling GI, 37% KDB GI. In terms of XGI though, KDB was slightly above, but it's so close. It really is so close. And you had things, you know, remember that 5-0 where he only got an assist in that game and he was just running the show despite bossing things. It kind of means that the XGI was probably a little bit undercooked for De Bruyne. In terms of, Elf said, in terms of space to grow, obviously you've got Sterling upward trajectory to bear in mind. So three seasons, 200 points, an average of 18 goals per season. Last year's 20 goals were his most ever. And KDB is an interesting one. I spoke to my friend Wee Rogue about this, because obviously he was injured and then came back last season, and we were kind of saying things like, oh, it could be a Yaya season for him last year. You know, it's very difficult to assess whether he's going to be able to keep this up. But the consensus seems to be, according to things like Understat, StatsBomb, that he finishes hot. So he scores more than he should, according to expected data. And his passes are a lot better than they should be, according to Opta XA. So it means players score more than average from the shots that he creates. Translating that into English, he's an elite player, shock horror, who in FPL terms has strong points potential in every game that he plays in. So earlier on I mentioned that XGI was my kind of crowning stat, and I think Kevin De Bruyne is kind of the epitome of that crowning stat in FPL. Penalties, I should mention as well, are huge for me here too. There have been 13 penalties awarded so far this season. Last year it took us up until game week 6 to get to that number. So yeah, more penalties. Man City have got the second most penalties awards than of all teams. They've got loads of players who have loads of touches in the box. They as a team have net highest touches in the box. I think they can have a lot of penalties. And despite the fact that, you know, there's on average one more penalty per team expected, I think that Man City will get more of those penalties. And the ownership, yeah, I don't really care about that, but it is in KDB's kind of ballpark at the moment. So all in all, I'm kind of just about on the side of KDB, but I can also see why you'd be going for Sterling if you were to kind of make that choice, because the ownership's pretty low. The guy is consistently scoring goals. It's just the case that Kevin De Bruyne has more routes to points, as it were. But that's why I kind of landed on KDB.
I just like to add a little bit of a context here. So basically what I did is I've done the goals plus assists per 90 for Sterling and De Bruyne versus opposition of different caliber. And what I noticed what happened last season was Sterling didn't do really well against good defenses or average defenses, but he exploded against the weaker defenses. His scores were 0.37 goals plus assists per 90 against really good defenses, 0.4 goals plus assists per 90 against average defenses, and 1.13 goals per assist was against really weak defenses. So he does tend to have an explosive streak, you know, against the weaker defenses. The case with De Bruyne, though, is he's consistent and he's really good against the good defenders as well as the middle defenders. That's because what we noticed tactically last season was against the good teams, De Bruyne tended to play further forward, having two defensive midfielders in the pivot. Now, that is something we might see more of this season because we don't have David Silva. So, Pep might play more defensive-minded midfielders behind him more regularly. So, that's something you need to be mindful about. Taking that into consideration and the penalty point that you spoke about, I feel like for a consistent stream of points, De Bruyne is a good set-and-forget option. But when the fixtures turn green and they're really good, you need to get in Sterling and try hitting a massive haul just for the captaincy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that certainly makes sense. So it kind of is true that I think you call them sticky players, don't you? The sort of Kevin De Bruyne type, the one that you just don't move out of your team, yeah?
The glue guys.
The glue guys, that's it, yeah. And I think that's definitely why I went for him as well, just because I think, well, I'm not going to be removing this guy, so I might as well get him in at base price, leave him there for the foreseeable future. Anyway, we've spoken enough. Nick, Anthony, what do you guys reckon? Anthony?
I've went off and dug some data myself on this. And what I did was I looked at last season and I looked at, in terms of per start for each player, their home form, their away form, and then how they did against all teams and against top teams. And what I think I found was that KDB is just better. He's better overall. He vastly outperforms his non-pen XG. And he scores in two of every five of his starts against all teams in the league. Sterling does score more times than KDB, of course. He scores about three in every five starts last season, but he's vastly outperformed by KDB in terms of assist potential and especially in terms of the actual assists. So Sterling, even a few years ago, he had particularly good assist numbers. Last season, we've spoken about how much poorer he was, but his assists of 0.48 per start in 2018-19 was still quite a bit less than KDB's 0.72 assists per start last season. So look, he would close the gap, but KDB would still be far ahead. In terms of home performances, it's basically a runaway show for KDB. He's about twice as good in terms of FPL points. He actually gets more goals than Sterling does at home, and he gets more assists as well, of course, about four times more assists per start. Away, actually, Raheem Sterling was better last season. He, of course, outscores. KDB is getting a goal about one in every four starts. For Raheem Sterling, it's four in every five starts away from home. Assists, De Bruyne, yes, better, but it doesn't make up for the fact that even Raheem Sterling is getting more bonus points away from home. And so Raheem Sterling last season ended up with 7.12 FPL points per start away from home, whereas Kevin De Bruyne, it was only 6.31. And then against the traditional top six plus Leicester last season, De Bruyne, much better on goals, much better on assists, much better on bonus points, three times better on bonus points, in fact. And so that ended up with 7.73 points per game against those top teams versus Raheem Sterling, it was 5.27. So you're seeing this chasm that has developed. Then, and a bit of an addendum, our friend Desperately Seeking Dusan, who is at Seeking Dusan on Twitter, Alan, he has put together some stats as well, which looked at kind of the explosivity or the haulability of these players. So for Alan, haul was anything which was 10 points or above, and explosive was anything which was 16 or above. And the facts bear out that, okay, you could say that over the last few seasons, Raheem Sterling is more explosive, so he's going to get more of those, you know, over 16 pointers. So he's had eight in the past two seasons, whereas De Bruyne only had three, of course, being injured for one of those seasons. But in terms of hauls, you would probably say that De Bruyne is just that little bit better. It was 10 last season versus 9 for Raheem Sterling. But there is a bit of a muchness of muchness there with regard to those particular statistics.
Yeah, exactly. I think sort of going back to FPO Elf in terms of how I originally answered that question, I've referenced Sterling perhaps being the more explosive of the duo, which is mainly to do with their reputations and history. As Sterling's obviously, he's got the reputation of being a goal scorer in simple terms, and De Bruyne a creator with assists, and you know the goals get 5 points for midfielders. You know, to bring it down to granular level, the assists only get 3 points, and in terms of hat tricks, Sterling has four Premier League hat tricks to his name. De Bruyne hasn't got a single one to his name as well. But obviously, yeah, when you factor in goals and assists, you know, you're talking about 15 or so points De Bruyne can easily make in a game week. And, you know, we saw this particular game week as well. It's very, very easy for him to kind of get a haul, which is only to get a haul, you only need about three returns. You can get a goal and two assists, and that's the equivalent of a haul. And watching Manchester City play, you kind of back De Bruyne almost to do that week in, week out, especially now that he has the penalties. When you factor that in, with Aguero being out, he's got those penalties, and the fact that he's also it's been announced that he's playing more of a number 10 position, more advanced. I know I sound like I'm flip-flopping a lot in terms of who I'm going for, but I think these additional factors that we didn't have on previous pods kind of leads me now towards more De Bruyne. And I think De Bruyne, he has that additional consistency factor. If Sterling perhaps has the higher point ceiling, we're only talking, as Elf pointed out, you know, minimal points, 1 or 2 points here. And to, when you take away that consistency that De Bruyne has, then for me, he's the better FPL asset.
Yeah, interesting. No, just to point out as well that so De Bruyne said that he didn't know whether he played the number 10 or not, but it seems like, and I think Pranil's right in terms of how Pep may set up the team now without David Silva being around, it looks like Foden's favoured on one of the wide forward spurts rather than being a central player. So it could well be that you've got kind of like defensive sort of double pivot behind him, and De Bruyne are allowed to run right number 10, and how glorious will that be? Yeah.
Just adding a little bit to that, when you're judging Sterling based on the eye test section that we did, I think in the middle part of the season, last season, he was hogging the touchline, which hasn't been the case since the project restart, and as well as the game that we saw last night against Fulham. He drifted into central positions more often than he did in the middle part of last season. So if he's continuing to drift infield, coming center, you know, if Jesus is moving wide and putting crosses in. If he's central, then he's still a good asset. So that's something you need to look at from the eye test, you know, when we talk about systems and iterations and all of that.
Exactly. I think a part of that factor as well is that Aguero is absent. So Gabriel Jesus is much better as a creator than Sergio Aguero. And so they kind of play off that and try and get Sterling into those positions, because he is getting there on pace alone. But in terms of his actual finishing ability, as we all know, it's just not quite up to scratch. And it's nowhere near, let's say, KDB's either in terms of his outperformance of non-pen XG. KDB was about doubling his non-pen XG. And so we're adding penalties to that formula, considering his stats weren't too padded by penalties last season. And I think it makes him just particularly potent. I think, digging through what everyone has said here, if you want a consistent captain, which is probably the secret in FPL, you probably go for Kevin De Bruyne. He's better against the top teams as well. You could even captain him against your Chelsea's or your Liverpool's, and it seems that he has a pretty good chance of returning for you. The thing is that as a flat track bully, and if they're playing against a West Brom, it seems like Raheem Sterling sometimes gets the edge on him a little bit more often than KDB would, than you would normally expect KDB to edge him.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, hopefully food for thought there, Alf. Hopefully you don't think of us as being the sort of people who just say things off the top of our head and actually bother to look into them.
So that's the end of our correspondence anyway. Thanks very much. If you have any correspondence, be they addendums, thoughts, clarifications or ideas, email whogottheassist@gmail.com. Get them in before Tom kills the section.
Yes, indeed. Well, from researched answers to answers off the top of our heads, let's go now into the quickfire Q&As. Thanks for the questions this week. I only put them up for about 10 minutes, so well done if you got those questions in. I apologise, I had 10 minutes to drink a cup of tea and I had to go into another meeting. So getting the questions, getting it all together, yeah, I haven't got very long. Let's start off with the first one, Zaha Gaga. And this could be one which is related to the eye test that we've seen. So FPL Fred asked if we're overlooking Wilf Zaha, given how good he looks and the fixtures to come for Crystal Palace. So of course he's been fielded as well in the number 9 role, but up front I should say, for Crystal Palace. Zaha 7.0, what do we think about this guy? Pranil, is he anywhere near that wild card of yours?
In that price bracket currently, based on what I've seen and the numbers, I prefer Harvey Barnes or Phil Foden.
I think that's fair enough, to be honest, because I'd maybe dug a little bit into this. So he was definitely overlooked for game week one, in spite of having a very good preseason. That was partly because Palace were poor in Project Restart. It was partly because Southampton and Manchester United, based on Project Restart form and last season's form, looked like a tough start. Southampton's kamikaze high line fed into Wilfred Zaha, and then Manchester United just being abysmal played into it for him. So in the end, he ended up with 6 shots and he scored 3 times from those 6, and he's had a goal ruled out for offside as well. Now, the thing is that, okay, that's a 50% shot conversion. That's obviously not sustainable for Wilfred Zaha. In last season, which was obviously quite a poor season for him, you can say he was distracted or whatever, he had a 6% shot conversion to goals. The season before that, when he did score 10 goals, that's his career best so far in the Premier League, he converted about 15% of his shots. So he's obviously overperforming right now. To what extent, you can decide for yourself. The thing with Palace is that They do have very good fixtures from Game Week 5, starting with Brighton and Fulham and then Wolves. Fine. The problem with Game Week 5 is that it's after the transfer deadline day, which is just after Game Week 4. Now, the thing with Zaha is he playing for a move away? And this is a question that's being asked constantly. Roy Hodgson, after the game the other day, quoted it saying about a move, "I have no idea if he'll leave. I look forward to going into work with him every day. I'm a realist, and I realise that if a club comes in and pays what the club thinks he is worth and he desperately wants to go, it'll be hard for us to keep him. But until that day comes, there is no point in me speculating." So I'm not going to speculate too far off that, but I'm a bit concerned about how well Zaha will do after Game Week 4 based on what we saw last season when he wasn't playing well but did turn it on at stages. And this is kind of part of the problem with him, is that, okay, great, everything has looked good so far, but what next?
I mean, what if, you know, players like Eberechi Eze has come in, for example, there's, you know, talk about Ryan Brewster coming in. Like, could these, and Batshuayi's got a good relationship with him, I hear. Like, you know, players like that could mean that suddenly the prospects of Palace look a little bit up. And I also wonder where else he'll go if he stayed in the Premier League. I mean, the doors of, you know, the notional top six are probably closed. I mean, I'm not sure Everton would take him now either. So where's he going to go apart from overseas? Yeah, no, I completely see what you mean about the transfer window being a bit of worry with him. One thing I would point out with Zaha is that he's got multiple routes to points, especially if this new penalty epidemic occurs. So touched in the box I mentioned earlier on is something that I'm going to be really paying attention to this year, just because players with more touches in the box stand more chance of being fouled. And over the last couple of years, Wilfred Zaha has finished third and fourth for touches in the box behind the likes of Salah and behind the likes of Hazard a couple of years ago. So it is definitely a player who is liable to get you those sort of pen assists, I suppose, as well as the goals, but it's very much up in the air with him. And I probably agree with Pernille that there are other options within that price bracket that I'd be very interested in.
One reason is that if Brewster comes, will Zaha play striker? He's been playing striker the first two games, so that might work against him.
Yeah. I think it's probably a bit of a personnel issue why he's playing striker rather than that being his role, like it was a couple of years ago when he was reclassified, of course. Oh, all right then, brilliant. Let's move on to the next question then, sorting it with the premiums. So Kumar Sanket at LFC Boot Room asks if Salah/Sterling or Mane/KDB is preferable on a wild card to kind of carry through the sword/shield sort of idea. I guess it's combinations of these players, and I suppose we would be, I don't know whether we'd be saying that it's a case of having Salah or Mane and one of the City players, or whether you kind of do both. I mean, Pranil, you're looking at two cities. I'm guessing that means no Liverpool for you.
That's what I'm contemplating right now. Currently, I feel like the next two fixtures, Leicester and Leeds for City, scream goals. And I feel like Liverpool are playing Arsenal and Villa, who aren't so defensively open. So I'm thinking of playing the Sterling card for the next 2 weeks, because I think the fixtures suit him, and then switching to Salah. That's what I'm thinking about right now.
I think it's possibly a case of like trying to over-engineer your team, I guess, if you're focused. I think we talked about ownership a little bit earlier on the pod, but if you kind of go for a sword/shield, you're thinking, oh, I'll have the highly owned De Bruyne and the differential of Mane, or the other way around, the highly owned Salah and the differential of Sterling. I think ultimately I wouldn't get too hung up on those sorts of things. In terms of the ownership, I'd focus on who you think is best primarily for your team, be it, you know, even a double City as Brunel's going for, you know, that might be the risk that you fancy going for, rather than perhaps trying to play it too safe or you know, try and focusing too much on those ownership stats.
Yeah, like for me, it's really, you're looking at these ownership stats right now, and I think you need to be a little bit cognizant of the fact that all the stats you see are last week's stats. Aubameyang was 47% owned going into the last game week. He has already, it's Tuesday night at the time of recording, he's well over 500,000 sales at this point. That's about 1 in 6 of his owners. That's going to go up even further. And so I think, you know, a lot of these combinations, your Salah, Sterlings, your Mane, KDBs, like these players are going to be picked up in pretty big droves. So don't overthink it, and probably just pick the two that you think are going to score the most, not the ones that you think are going to be less owned or might give you some sort of advantage. I personally am holding on to Salah because I just happen to have him in my side and I'm not wildcarding. If I was brave and chasing upsides and looking at fixtures, yeah, I think I could totally see why you'd go for the City double up. But just don't split hairs too much is pretty much what I'm saying to Mr. LFC Boot Room.
Yeah, I think in this case, swording and shielding is something which perhaps comes into play later on in the season when the template, as it were, takes root. And then you've got the kind of the mix between the engaged and the non-engaged managers. You've got the dead teams that start to occur. At this point in the season, you probably have the majority of the manager base still involved, still playing. Wait until kind of after the first international break and things will start to solidify a little bit. One thing I point out as well is that, okay, I mean, I've seen that he's removed, for example, separated Salah and KDB here. I mean, Salah's owned by 35% at the moment, near enough. KDB's owned by 32%, near enough. Combine the two together, though, and just under 8% of managers own both of those players. So you may be looking at it thinking, oh, you know, these players can be so highly owned, they're owned by everybody. Oh, no, I can't do that. Yeah, you can, because at this point in the season, we haven't got that built-in template. So having these sorts of players in combinations actually a hugely potent differential, even if they do, on the first look, seem really boring to own. But, I don't use negative terms, yeah.
But for what it's worth, they will probably be in about 20% of teams come this weekend. So it is kind of the time to, as a combination, I mean. So it's kind of, it's worth jumping now while there's a lot of people jumping, if, you know, there is a pair that you particularly fancy.
Yeah, but that still means 80% of the game don't own.
Oh yeah, it's good. Geez,
that's what's brilliant about it.
Well, you know? I know, it's great to be going ahead of 80% of the game. I agree. Yeah. That was the best thing about Salah getting that hat trick in game week one, is that like 70% of people didn't have him. You know,
yeah, that's what's brilliant about the early stages, I think. Before we get kind of everybody jumps aboard, kind of those huge life rafts in terms of those huge players who are performing well. Cool. Next one, upside chasing. Oh, very good guess for this one. FPLatics asks, when's it time to jump on and off an underperforming premium? Do we hold on to players that have accumulated lots of value from price rises each year for too long? He says he always seems to have this issue every year. And to be fair, I think we do as well to some extent. So, for example, I'm thinking about Vardy last year. I think we all three of us perhaps held on to him for a little bit longer than we should have. But one man who does not have an issue with this, who's ruthless with his premiums, is Pranil. How do you kind of conceptualize this question? What would you say to FPLatics here?
I'd say that fixtures matter when it comes to these big hitters. And there's what I've looked at some data, and there's a considerable difference when they play against weaker opposition and stronger opposition, unless you're KDP, who is consistent throughout. So what I'd say is, if you're trying to build strategies this year, KDB sort of is sticking out as the glue guy who you keep throughout. And in your head, you sort of preconceive that there's this one or two big hitter positions that I'd like to switch consistently because of the captaincy. So you're sort of not committing to, going chaotic and, making big hitter switches all over the place. You know, you have one glue guy in place there's going to be a lot to be done for his numbers to drop off. And then you have one or two positions which you're switching, and don't worry about value too much. At the end of the day, I always say it's about, picking a Jimenez instead of a Timo Werner. And it's about finding one player who's going to be 1 million lesser, and he might even outperform the more expensive players. So don't worry about value too much.
I'm going to ask you, though, what about hits, though, in this sort of early stage of the season? Because I can see a lot of managers are taking hits. They're taking minus fours. We've seen it between sort of Sons and Brunos and Aubameyangs to De Bruyne's this week. Would you say that's a little bit of a risk when you're talking about the premium assets? Because obviously we know that some of the premiums, they can perform week in, week out, regardless of the opposition.
Especially those guys taking minus eights, by the way.
No, I think early season is actually one of the best times to take hits, because if you're not wildcarding, you're setting up your team long-term. And what I also think this helps in terms of is the butterfly effect. So if you're not taking, a minus eight this week, and then there are still fires to be put out in your team, what you're constantly doing on a regular basis is putting out fires in your team instead of taking and making aggressive moves, which enable you to, make 20, 30 points over the opposition. So put out those fires in one go. You won't think about it 2 weeks later and then move on.
That's it. I think proactive transfers is the main reason I started with Martial on my bench, and the main reason I set up like I did in the first place. So that's why I took the minus eight, pull the plaster off. In the past, I've kind of gone, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. I want to save the points. I want to do this and do this. And I just found myself, as you say, in a kind of a losing firefighting battle where I end up having to take a hit anyway. So get out of the way as soon as possible was my point of view. Let's hope all that kind of works out.
I think that's a really, really good point, actually, about the butterfly effect. So one of my dilemmas right now is whether I am going to take a minus four. As many people probably know, I'm a bit more of a cautious manager in terms of taking hits. I try and avoid them if I can, and try and use the transfers I've got to kind of make those decisions. But this week, it probably will end up being a minus four. So I could probably take out St. Maximin because he's injured for Podence perhaps. And then I'm looking at Aubameyang to De Bruyne as well as a potential minus four. But that's the thing, if I'm like, oh, I'll keep the faith in Aubameyang because he's a premium, even though he's playing Liverpool, that just means I've got that transfer that I still want to make. I want to get in De Bruyne the next week, won't I? And then there's probably going to be some other fire that I've got to put out for game week four. So I think that does really help in terms of, you know, being aware that if you're going to avoid a hit one week, you might just be forced into that same hit the following week because you didn't make that move early enough.
Yeah, so dragging us on to the next question is the question of called Formation Station from Ujan Ghosh, and he asks, broadly, is 3-5-2 our go-to now? And he also mentions Werner and Jimenez being up front. Vardy Boys also asked us about Bamford.
Dear me. So 3-5-2, I think definitely we started off the season right back at the price pods thinking, oh, you know what? Yeah, it's all about the midfielders. Screw the strikers. Don't care about them. They're bad value, yada, yada, yada. And now it's the case, I just want every single striker there is going. I don't care what they look like. Don't care. I just want them in my team. I'm annoyed there's only three slots that I can actually have. I mean, in terms of Werner and Jimmy, Werner this week, Jimmy, the next five for Wolves are absolutely fabulous. So, Jimmy has actually entered my team. Bamford as well has surprised Nick and I, who's not done a paddy this year. He's actually done pretty well. But I mean, it definitely does seem the case that there's so much sort of value, so many choices in the forward line at the moment, especially in terms of all price points, that it's tough to kind of sit there and think a 3-5-2 is the best thing, just because at the moment, at least, it looks like the strikers do provide you with that mixture of talismanhood, talismanic nature, plus, obviously, 2 weeks of data, the output. I wouldn't be looking at 3-5-2 at the moment. I'd kind of be thinking, yeah, a 7 million striker or 7.2 now in Calvert-Lewin is outperforming the 7 million midfielder. Yeah, you've got to just follow your nose, as it were, in terms of this. And I'd just be kind of thinking, yeah, you've got to go to the free strikers, I think. What do you guys think?
Yeah, exactly. I think generally I've been critical of the first striking option over the past few years, saying there's been more value in defenders at the same price, but it's certainly not the time or place to be preaching that, especially when we had these sort of record scoring goal weeks. You know, as you said, there's so many options right now, like Bamford, Mitrovic, Mopay, Ings, Dominic Calvert-Lewin, Woods, all relatively cheap forwards, all scoring this week. You know, some of the ones, unfortunately, I own the more premium forwards like Werner and Vardy didn't score, so I didn't do as well this week, but I still backed them to also deliver. And you've even got some of the premiums like Kane as well, also presenting themselves perhaps as FPL options that we haven't strongly considered. And with that in mind, you know, I'm not necessarily thinking about the 3-5-2. I think it's more about the 3-4-3, the traditional 4-4-2 of the FPL world, going for that sort of all-out attack, as many forwards as you can fit into your team. It definitely seems to be the zeitgeist right now.
I agree. I think there are too many forward options. And just one name I'd like to add to the pool of players that you guys have mentioned, I'm strongly considering, is Gabriel Jesus as well. Aguero's not going to be playing for a while. So yeah, there's a flurry of forward options. I see myself going 3-4-3 for sure.
I saw big man Bakar put Jesus into his wild cards, and God, that last minute goal, he must have been celebrating that big time. But yeah, no, absolutely. And I think I was expecting him to prop up a bit more in the questions this week, and I'm glad that we've got onto him a little bit, because 9.5 million is a route into that City attack. I mean, obviously his finishing is not great. It's like me after 10 beers, but still he is you know, representative of that attack. And the long kind of held adage was that if Kun Aguero was out injured, then you bought Jesus and vice versa, because they're nailed on in that team. Is there something that we're missing there with Jesus? I mean, I had him at the end of last season. I think one game he got me a goal and two assists, which was great. Last game of the season, he got the opening goal, but that was kind of it. It became the KDB show after that. About 9.5 million is a route into the City attack. If he's a nailed-on member of that City attack, surely that's one we should be considering more, right? Anthony, what do you think about that and this whole kind of question?
Okay, on the Jesus front, first of all, like, of course he's a solid pick. It's just 9.5 genuinely seems a bit steep, and it's just, I guess, the opportunity cost of picking him up at 9.5 for me is a little bit great. But I guess right now I'm, you know, pretty keen on Timo Werner. That may change after this week, I guess, if he blanks for a third week in a row. I know circumstances and everything, all things considered, he has looked energetic, but still hasn't actually finished a chance yet. And I may start to get a little bit etsy about Chelsea as a concept almost and just move to Man City en masse, and then he would be a perfect replacement.
Pulisic and Zaj in the training pictures, they trained with the first team today, so that's interesting.
Yeah, that would help him. You wouldn't think Timo Werner's place is under threat, and that's the reason why I was quite happy to pick him. Whereas even, you know, after a few, I guess, disappointing games, you won't know what's going to happen with Tom's man or Mason Mount for that matter in that side. So yeah, look, we'll stick with Werner for now and see what happens against West Brom. As for the formation question, 3-4-3, 3-5-2. Like, look, there's arguments for both of them. There's so many low grade strikers who are doing quite well at the moment. None of the ones that I own, for what it's worth, but there's certainly quite a few of them doing well. And also in terms of the midfielders, there is five decent options there that you can afford instead of a balanced team. Given that there's so many of the elite ones are playing well. Okay, great, good start. And then you look at, you know, your James Rodriguez, your Zaha, your Foden, your Barnes, that mid price, and then at that 5.5 mid, all of your Leeds guys basically who've been, you know, scoring about as many as they did in the whole championship season in 2 weeks between Klitsch and Costa, and then Podence as well. They've all been doing particularly well. So yeah, okay, you can have both of them. I can see why anyone would argue for both of those right now. Certainly not big at the back.
No, certainly not, hey? Right, and the final question this week is a one for Pernell, but we can give our views after this. It's from FPL Dougal, aka Billy the Kid. He says, Pernell, you've just hit, well, he says late riser, but I'm going to call you Pernell because that's your name. He says, you've just hit the wildcard button. What criteria did you go through to reach that decision? I suspect you've already gone through this on the FPL wire, so a little bit of duplication, but hopefully that's okay. And does this criteria change from season to season? And desperately seeking Dusan, who you mentioned earlier, also asks, you know, do you put a point value on your wild card?
One thing I'd like to say is if this wasn't COVID circumstances, or if this wasn't a year in which we had, you know, probably blanks and doubles in game week 18 and 19 that we might need to plan for, I would have wildcarded on Saturday without giving it another thought. The reason I was thinking and overthinking it until today afternoon when I pulled the plug was because I wanted to try saving it, but then there are a few questions that I asked myself. Am I confident of the glue guys and the budget picks that are emerging, you know, in the ecosystem of players that are there? Yes. Am I betting on what looks like sure things? Yes, because I'm betting on Man City and Wolves, and they've been pretty consistent in the past couple of years. You don't need to worry too much about those players when you're, you know, betting big on them. Am I using this wildcard as a nitro boost as well as a, you know, get out of jail card? Yes, because I had a double Saints defense. I had Dele Alli, who's not going to be in the fray. I had Bissouma, you know, who has a red card. Saint Max, who was seemingly injured. I'm not interested in him in the 5.5 price bracket. So yeah, there were these considerations that happened. And I pulled a -8 yesterday. And it seemed like I was, you know, doing half measures. It seemed like a middle ground option where, yeah, I'm taking that -8 this week, but I still have a lot of fires to put out. So I just thought that, you know what, I'll go the entire way and not play on the back foot, you know, just putting off fires every week, and play on the front foot and start making luxury moves.
Tom was holding his hand up there and counting the players that you were transferring out, and you got to five really fires that had to be put out. And I guess then you could say that, let's say, grabbing the initiative was another, you know, six or seven moves that you might have wanted to make. So yeah. Was it just a case of ask not what your team could do for you, but what you could do for your team?
I really wanted to save that wildcard because of future uncertainties, but I just thought the good thing is once I pulled the wildcard and, you know, I started building the team, I started feeling a lot better about it once I did it, because then I was like, okay, I have a team that I can play with and I can have fun with and I can make luxury moves week on week. I was more skeptical than most seasons this time because I wanted to save it, but it just made sense.
Okay. I mean, to answer Desperate Seeking Dusan's question, then, that sounds like you got five sort of issues there. So that's already kind of a -16, isn't it? I mean, yeah. If you add on an extra two, you're looking at -20, -24. Like, yeah. At what point did it tip you? I mean, if I had three issues this week, which were Shea Adams, ASM, and I wanted the Man City player. So that, for me, was enough to do a -8. But, you know, with the double Southampton defence, with Bissouma, with all the things that you catalogued, I think that I probably have pulled the wild card as well. Like, is it kind of a -5 moves you want to make? Is that kind of the threshold you tend to set, or does it just depend season to season?
So I think if there are fires in your team that are close to -12, and on top of that you can see a few moves that you're sure about that will work around the edge of your team, I think it's a good enough reason to pull the wild card.
Sure. No, I think I'm still on the original track of trying to hold my wild card until that sort of game week 18-19 business. But I agree with you that I'd doggedly not be holding on to it just because I want to get there. I'd much prefer to get there in a decent OR and then have to use a few hits to work that out rather than getting there at a crap OR, then using my wild card, navigating that fine, but still having lost loads of points from people like yourself who have taken the initiative. And I wouldn't have really hesitated if I had a similar sort of number of fires in my team this week to pull it.
And I'm sitting at 4.5 million OR. You don't want to be taking a minus 8 sitting on that.
No, no. Things are going to get better for you anyway. You can get green arrows in the next 10 weeks and be in a great mood. So there you go. Right, guys, what do you guys think about this sort of wild card business? I mean, just in general, how do you think Pernil's reasoning sounds? Is that something that you agree with?
I have been tempted by the early wild card. I know you were sort of asking whether I was going to do it this week or suggesting perhaps I should go for it if I fancy it. But like, I mean, looking at my game week 3 team, most of the fixtures are pretty rubbish. But then like some of the players that, you know, you could say maybe I would think about wildcarding out, like Vardy, you know, or even like Justin, even though he's had a good start because they've got Manchester City, you know, they then have really couple good fixtures in game week 4 and game week 5. And that was part of the reason that I put those guys in my team at the start of the season for those sort of plum home games against West Ham and Aston Villa. And I think Vardy could be like a really good differential for those particular game weeks. So I'm a little bit of resistant to that. Same with some of the other, you know, rogues that are in my team, like Mitrovic. You know, he was in there because of his decent opening fixtures this week. He's got Aston Villa at home. Aston Villa a little bit improved defensively, but still I see that as, you know, a fixture where he could easily get some returns. And, you know, obviously the likes of Salah as well. So it's actually like when I look at my team, there's only really a couple of players that I really want to take out. The rest of them, you know, they don't have great fixtures, but they're fine to sit there. So I don't see any urgency at the moment for the game to make the wild card. But I think game week 5 was one that I was targeting. I have started targeting in terms of doing the wild card because there's certainly a number of moves I could make that game week. You know, with the likes of Leicester having a fixture shift, the likes of Manchester City also having a fixture shift. Even then, I might start thinking about perhaps a risky triple up on Manchester City or something crazy like that perhaps could work for the game week 5. And it's also what I like about Game Week 5 as well, is past the transfer window as well. So that's all closed. So then you don't need to worry too much about what's happening with your team. And you've also got, I think it's just after the international break, but you've got a little bit of, a little bit of closure, I guess, in terms of the early team's form, who's good, who's looking good in the underlying metrics at this particular moment in time. We've only really got two game weeks worth of data, and it, you know, as we saw, like I think it was the best team in game week 1 or the star team in game week 1, none of them returned in game week 2, did they? So you know, it's very early in terms of trying to identifying that team and that player form.
Yeah, look, I'd be pretty much copy pasting a lot of what Nick said. Like, I would say I have quite a lot of kindling in my team but no particular fire just yet. So the likes of Matt Doherty, for example, I'm not too put off him just yet. It's a game against Newcastle, who just seriously struggled last week. Doherty himself has had a very good goal-scoring chance in the first game week of the season. He had an assist for a goal that was ruled out in game week 2 as well. He isn't getting forward as much as I'd like to see. Certainly he wasn't in game week 2, but at the same time, I'm not classifying him as a fire, let's say. And I guess maybe if a lot of people maybe would call that a fire, and I guess if I'm taking that approach to the rest of my team, I'm just quite content with it. I'd always considered that game week 4 would probably be the time I wildcarded just after game week 4, going into so the transfer deadline just about passes then, and also we have the international break, so there is a chance if I wanted to make the most of price rises to try and do that. But to be honest, I don't think I'm going to be too obsessive about that, because I think most of, you know, what you might see is the money I would be gaining or losing, I'm just going to probably absorb by buying Mitchell, who's probably going to be, you know, he'll save me 0.3 on one of my 4.5 defenders, and that pretty much sorts out most of the budgetary issue that I might have had otherwise. So I'm just quite content with my side overall, and I'm not going to rip it up just yet. But if I had five things to move like Pernil had, then yeah, I would 100% have pulled the wildcard trigger.
Cool. I think we're verging into the final bit anyway, but let's move on to the transfers and captains. Hoping that games do go ahead, obviously. At the time of recording, we've just received the news that David Moyes and a couple of his first team players have gone down with COVID. Let's hope for the best and hope that this pod doesn't end up in the bin like the one with Ben Crellin did, for being completely irrelevant. But hopefully the teams will go ahead, because I've taken a -8. Bruno's got a wild card and Stags made his transfers too. Bit of a spoiler. First, though, let's go to Nick. What are you doing? What transfer are you looking to make? And who's your captain going to be?
Oh, I think I am leaning now towards the minus four. I think St. Maximin is injured, so he's definitely going to go. And looking at the 5.5 million type options, there's a few of the Leeds guys look pretty interesting, but I think I'm leaning more towards Poland just because of Wolves' fixtures, and he looks like a decent pick at that price point. So I think Poland will probably come in for St. Maximin, and then it's probably going to be Aubameyang out of the team as well. I'm jumping on the wagon there and bringing in Kevin De Bruyne. I think it just has to be done, doesn't it? So it looks like it's probably going to end up being a hit. In terms of the captain, it's a bit of a differential captain, I guess, because I've got on Timo Werner actually at the moment. So West Brom have been atrocious so far this season defensively. They've conceded more goals than any other club, and they've also conceded joint most shots on target. So it's going to be Werner, even though he hasn't scored yet. He's definitely got the pedigree, as we've seen in the Bundesliga, and he's had a bright start. So I think I'm going to go for a little bit of differential captain there as my captain pick.
Cool. Right. Pranil, we know you're wildcarding, but where's your captain going to be? What's your thinking about that? So you're nodding along to Nick talking about Werner. Is that kind of similar for you? I know you captained Game Week 1, for example. Are you going there again?
No, I think I'm going to go with the City asset for sure. Like you mentioned earlier in the pod, you know, Leicester don't bother defending. Justin's a really poor player. Castagna, again, doesn't defend too much. And if City could score 3 goals against Wolves, I wonder how many they can put across Leicester. So I'm definitely going to be captaining one of De Bruyne or Sterling.
That's actually quite interesting, because I would say when it comes to those City players, there isn't nothing to stop them scoring 3, let's say, against Leicester. And I think we need to kind of keep that in mind sometimes. It's easy to think, oh, Leicester were a top team last season, but there is definitely shades of what is good in the Premier League, and City are just a cut above most teams. And they really do punish even the teams that are around them, much more so than, let's say, Liverpool would. At the moment, though, my armband is on Timo Werner. Okay, 6 shots, 5 of them in the box. Pretty poor XG so far. But I have liked his glib, and I've really hated seeing West Brom so far this season. So that's where the armband currently is. But my transfer has already been made, and that was Aubameyang to Kevin De Bruyne. And I did that after the Wolves game. So I wasn't doing it based on the Wolves game, but I was doing it to make sure that he wasn't injured or something before I pulled that particular trigger. Will I take a hit? No, not unless there's something pretty crazy happens the rest of this week, let's say with West Ham or something.
Cool, fair enough. And I've taken mine's 8, as I mentioned earlier on. Hopefully the games are going to go ahead. But I basically did what I said earlier on, try to be proactive, try to set my team up without using that wild card. So it was a wild card saver. I removed Shea Adams, I removed ASM, and I removed Aubameyang, and I've put in Kevin De Bruyne, I've put in Raul Jimenez, and I put in a 4.5, unfortunately, in Anguissa. That means that Suchek is now promoted to the first team. The reason I did that on Sunday night was because Shea Adams was going to drop, and I would have been priced out. And if I'd have left it another night, then I'd have been 0.2 out. So it was kind of a calculated risk with a wild card in hand. Went for it, and I'm going to captain De Bruyne straight off the bat for the reasons we've spoken about. There's been a lot of people who are actually pointing to Salah versus Arsenal and kind of saying, oh, have you seen how bad Arsenal have been against Liverpool over the last few years? Yep, I completely understand that, but I mean, this is Arteta's Arsenal now, and I think I find it very difficult to get excited about captaining a player against Arsenal at this moment in time, just because the way we're setting up isn't as naive, dare I say it, as it was in the past. I'm now condemning us to a 5-0 defeat, of course, but I just don't, I just can't see it. And I think maybe this is an example of looking at the data, to go back to the main point of this pod, and looking at the eye test and thinking to yourself, okay, right, the historic data says this, but what have you seen, and how have Arsenal been playing compared to how Leicester have been playing? Yeah, like last year they were very good defensively. This year they can't defend particularly well. So it feels like KDB for me, and I'll probably give Salah the vice as a good default, but I'm probably not going to captain them, even though I can see why people would be going that way.
A big factor in the Arsenal and Salah captaincy, I think, is we need to see whether Tierney is going to be playing in that position or Kolasinac. And I think that's a factor that might swing either way.
Yeah, definitely if Kolasinac is in that particular position, I think Salah could have a field day. It would definitely change my own particular perspective on that.
Cool. So thanks, guys. So we were Who Got The Assist. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And if you're a new listener and enjoyed the pod this week, don't forget to hit that subscribe button, and you can listen to us all season long.
Yeah, the mini league code is CPSULF. And please leave a review of the podcast if you enjoyed. Thank you very much. And we'll be back next week to survey the wreckage of game week 3. If you have any correspondence, any addendums, thoughts, clarifications, or ideas, get them into whogottheassist@gmail.com. And thanks so much for joining us, Pranil Late Riser. You can find him on Twitter at LateRiser12, all one word.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's been a pleasure. And keep doing the good job that you guys do.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pranil. Thanks for your time. Thank you. It's almost 2 a.m. now, is it?
2:15.
2:15. Enough to sink one more scotch before bedtime, right?
About the time a game ends.
Yeah, okay. Awesome. Well, thanks very much for your time. And listeners, we hope this is you. Think about criteria to buy in players for the season. Good luck in game week 3, and we'll speak to you next week. Goodbye.
Get that correspondence in, bye.
I'm so gonna cut that. I give it until game week 8.
No, man, it's gonna the river is just gonna start to overflow into the inbox. You know, you're gonna wake up and it's like 100 emails.
Just mail. Just
I'm excited to see what happens with this section in the future.
Yeah. I'm kind of, to be honest, like the tension I'm trying to build up with the section has just become into a tension about the section.
It's like beg people for correspondence.
Yeah.
This was the first one that like came itself. I just
that's a soliciting, I'd call that. Anyway, thanks, Pranil. That was really good.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist?
Sports Social Podcast Network.